have a theory that that writing, and specifically handwriting, is perhaps the represent the apex of human technology. Like, it may be the most impressive thing technologically that we have ever achieved, or we will ever achieve. You know, it's completely vital for every single it's completely vital for everything that you know, everything we've achieved since. Seamus Heaney used to have a thing. He would say, you know, you'd see a video or something of a spacewalk or the moon landing or something like that, and then he'd say, it's because of poetry that this spacewalk is possible. Because without poetry, you don't have any writing, and without writing, you don't have technology. Every few months there's a study that comes out that says something to the effect of, and it makes me very happy to see so many analog note takers in class. Because almost every three or four months, a study will come out and basically say that taking notes via handwriting is better for you. It's better for your mind and your brain than taking typewritten notes. And there are a couple of reasons for this. One is that most people, even when they're told not to, cannot resist the temptation when they take notes to, when they're typing, take notes verbatim. So, because most of us can type much faster than we can write by hand. I know I can. I've got very fast typing speed. And if for most people, if you're taking notes and you're typing them, when you hear somebody speaking or somebody giving a lecture, you tend to just write down what they say verbatim instead of actually thinking about it and processing it. When you're writing things out by hand, you have to be much more strategic about what you write down, because you can't write as fast. Most of us can't. Unless you know shorthand, you can't write as fast as someone can talk. And so you have to do something which is called encoding, which is where when you hear people saying things, you take it and you process it and you boil down a paragraph to a sentence, or you boil down a sentence to two or three key words. And so they'll do stuff. And the one that just came out, it was on NPR, and I read about it this morning. And essentially, they took a bunch of university students, which are the traditional guinea pigs of all psychological tests, are university students. Now, this may, in fact, have skewed every psychology test that's ever been made in some really horrible ways. But if there's anyone who needs to take notes, it's probably university students. And so they took a bunch of university students and they set them down in front of a bunch of TED Talks, which, if you haven't seen a TED Talk is like a 30 or 45 minute lecture on a subject, and they sort of bring somebody in who's an expert. Some of them are quite good. Some of them are kind of loony, but some of them are quite good. And they sat down two groups in front of the lecture, and the groups were randomly selected, and one of them were told to take notes typing, but don't write things down verbatim, like take real notes. The other group is given a pen and paper and said, take notes. And then at the end of the lectures, what they found was that the group with the laptops, even though they'd been told not to write things down verbatim, they had done it anyway, because you can't resist the urge to do that. But what they found was that there were two different kinds of facts that they quizzed the students on. And the first kind of facts were things like basically names and dates. And both groups got the names and dates equally well. Neither of them had a problem with that. But when you started to give them questions about giving them a question of comparison or a question of value, a question of saying, all right, how did Sweden and Japan, you know, deal with this social issue differently over the course of the last 50 years? The group with the laptops in the words of the test performed very poorly. So in other words, what they had done is they copied things down verbatim, but they hadn't really thought about what they were hearing. And whereas the people who were taking notes, and this is the real value of note-taking, I think it's not just so that you can go back and look at your notes later. Yes, that is really helpful, and I am obsessive-compulsive when it comes to archiving. I have a whole shelf just of little notebooks that I filled up. They're all small black notebooks. And I'm writing in them all day, and it freaks my coworkers out. They're like, what are you writing in your little black notebook all day? You know, just stuff. Don't worry about it. It's just stuff. I'm probably fine. You're probably safe. I'm sure your name's not in here at all. It's probably fine. But But it's not primarily just so you can go back and look at your notes later. It's the encoding. It's the act of trying to process the information and think about, you know, look for the nuggets, look for the most important parts. The act of doing that makes a place for it in your mind that typing it out verbatim just doesn't do. Now, in a very roundabout way, I think this is one of the real values of reading some of the poetry in the Bible. So when, in a sermon, or a lesson like this one, or just in a long, just a didactic passage, if you're just told, do this thing, don't do this thing, if you do this thing, then these things will happen to you. Like, if you just hear that, it gets a little rote after a while, right? Like, it gets... Have you ever thought about how much redundant information there is in the Bible? Like, if you only needed to say something once, like if the one saying and the most straightforward and efficient way of saying something was the best way to do it, then there would only be one passage in the Bible about idolatry, and there would only be one passage in the Bible about adultery, and there would only be one passage in the Bible about love, and all these different things. It would be a very short Bible, yes. Yes, it would. Because you just have one text for each subject. But that's not what we get in the Bible. In the Bible, we have 66 texts written by different authors over long periods of time, engaging with these same subjects over and over again, but in different ways. And one of the things that poetry does for us is, because it's hard, because it requires a more than trivial effort to process and to parse, and like you have to think about, okay, but what's the poet really saying here, right? It encodes it for us. It creates a place for it in our minds. We have to sort of pick it up and handle it and turn it around and look at it from all these different angles, and it creates a relationship with it that we wouldn't get if somebody was just telling us straightforward, here's the thing, now go do the thing, right? So, in this passage last week, we saw Isaiah start out with the parable of the vineyard, which is this poem. It's this beautiful song. It's actually, especially in Hebrew, it's one of the most beautiful passages poetically, just the way it's structured and the paronomasia and the assonance and all these different things. It's one of the most beautiful passages of Hebrew poetry in the Bible. And he starts out with this parable and he says, "My beloved," and this is Isaiah singing about the Lord, "my beloved had a vineyard." Right? "My beloved had a vineyard, and he went and he dug all the stones out of the ground," which is not an insignificant task in Palestine, or Palestine. Palestine is in East Texas. Sorry, I keep doing that. He dug it up, he fertilized it, he planted the vineyard, he built a wall or a hedge around it to protect it, he built a tower to watch over it, he did all these things, and he says, "Judge if there's anything that I could not have done for my vineyard, or that I could have done for my vineyard that I didn't do." In other words, he's blameless, he's faultless. But what does his vineyard give him? Not grapes, but wild grapes. Grapes which look on the outside like normal grapes. But inside, they're not sweet, they're not fruitful, they're not nourishing. They are acrid and bitter and full of poison. And what we are sort of challenged to do as we read passages like this one is to pick it up and turn it around and look at it and not just think, okay, obviously God is the husbandman here, and or he's the beloved here, and Judah is the vineyard. Yes, that is literally in the text. That is what is going on right now. That is the parable which Isaiah is telling. But what we're encouraged to do beyond that is, as we're thinking about this poem, thinking about this poetry, and trying to think about what it means, we're encouraged to pick it up, take a look at it, look at it from some different angles, and see where we can find ourselves in it. And it's not to say we should just make every passage about us primarily, and that's certainly what I want to avoid. There's a really poor way of doing exegesis, which basically says, take a story in the Bible, replace anything bad with the bad stuff that you're facing, David and Goliath. Replace Goliath with whatever bad stuff you happen to be facing this week. Replace David with you, and then replace whatever David used to overcome Goliath with whatever means you need to overcome the bad stuff that you're facing. And that's a really sloppy way of exegesis. and I'm not going to do that here. But as Isaiah is dealing with a sinful nation who has rejected God, who has embraced sin, and who is now put themselves in a place where they are subject to God's judgment, I think there's a lot that we can find in this passage that does have a lot to do with us. And I think there's a lot that we can find in this passage, like, you know, to identify ourselves with, that is maybe not, you know, super flattering, but might be what we need to hear. So Isaiah, after the parable of the vineyard last week, we saw he went on to start addressing these different groups of people. And basically this passage after from verse 8 on through the end of the chapter. By the way, let me just say, I did spend some time this morning. I'm behind on other things for the church now, but I did spend some time this morning getting all of the previous lessons edited and uploaded to the church website. So if in the RSS feed. So if for some reason you've had to miss, or you just want to listen to something again for some reason, those are all available there, and we're all caught up to last week. So there should be 9 lessons there. I know, right? Yeah, pretty. Yeah. Yeah. I'm completely behind on the special music schedule now, but you know, that's another thing. It's always a lot of life seems to be about picking which thing I'm going to be caught up on this week, you know, and at the expense of life. But anyway. So the last 9 lessons are all up there. If you've missed for some reason, you might catch up. So we saw last week that starting in verse 8 of Isaiah chapter 5, that Isaiah starts declaring woes against different groups of people. And along with these woes, there are these therefore statements. So basically, he'll deal with a group of like 2 or 3 groups of people, and then he'll say a therefore, and then he'll say, here's the kind of judgment that is coming because of this kind of sin. And the sins in this chapter are sort of roughly divided into 2 categories, which last week, do you guys remember what we called those categories? Thick and clear. Yes. Hey, nice. I do you have your last week's handout in front of you there too? And that's, yes. Awesome. That's what those are. That's what it's okay. That's what those are there for. That's good. Okay. So we talked about thick and clear sins. And this is Lewis's terminology, but I think it's really helpful here. So a thick sin is it's a physical sin. It's a sin of the appetite. It's the sin of the flesh. These are things like lust, things like gluttony. These are basically, you know, it's typified by the belly is the part of your body that sort of typifies it. And it's all about satisfying what's your physical desires and your physical wants and your physical, you know, urges. And God deals with 2 groups of people here. Those who are a covetous people. These are people who are looking to set house beside house and field beside field. They're violating the spirit of the year of Jubilee. In other words, they're buying up land they're just overcome with greed. And they're just overcome with a desire to just have all of their properties next to each other, house next to house and field next to field. And it's just this want for more and more and more. And this is the desire for good earthly things, which God has given us, but out of proportion. So these are loves out of proportion. And the second one is woe to a debauching people. We saw people rising early to seek after wine, getting up early in the morning so they have more time to party. Surrounding themselves with a constant partying atmosphere, and this includes surrounding themselves with constant music. And we talked about how music is a good thing, which God has given us, and certainly, this passage is no more an indictment against wine in that sense than it is against music. But what it is saying is that here's someone who has stopped, Psalm 104 says that God gave wine to gladden the hearts of men. But here's someone who has become so obsessed and so wrapped up with the gift that they have lost sight of the hand of the giver. This is somebody who's become so obsessed with surrounding themselves and self-medicating themselves with the constant noise of instruments, which is alike, I think, a lot of our music today, that they have lost sight of what music was supposed to do, which is to show God to us, to give us a vision of beauty. So what these two groups of people have in common, these covetous people and these debauching people, what they both have in common is that they're both completely consumed by their appetites. They have become so obsessed with a gift that they can no longer see the hand of the giver. They can no longer see God's goodness in his gifts. So those are the first two groups of people. And what was the punishment that we saw for them? What was the therefore? Do you guys remember? It was really poetic. Was that? Well, it is captivity generally, yes, but there's something really evocative. Not just insatiable hunger. Their hunger for these things isn't, what's that? Unquenchable appetites, yes. And go on to the therefore. It's in verse 14. Thank you, Granny. Verse 14. Hell, Sheol. And here, Sheol is envisioned as a monster. One commentator says dragon, which I don't know that the text necessarily demands that interpretation, but I like it. I like it a lot. Everything is 100% better with dragons. You cannot give me an example of anything which would not be better if you put a dragon in it. It's this idea of hell as this monster. And it's saying, you think your appetites are enlarged. You think your appetites are boundless. But here is hell. Here's the destruction that is coming towards you. And the mouth of hell has enlarged its appetite. It is opened wide. It's opened its mouth beyond measure. And all of you who have been living to satisfy your flesh, you're going to be swallowed up by something whose appetite is even more insatiable than yours. So that's the therefore statement for that first group, those first two groups of people who are both exemplify these thick sins, which we talked about. So this morning, what we're going to get onto is the clear sins. So it's kind of a long review, but because it's really all one lesson and all one passage, I wanted to make sure we spent some time on it so you would still have, as we get into these clear sins, that you would have the thick sins there in the back of your mind so you can kind of weigh them and contrast them. So let's go ahead and get into our first reading this morning. This is going to be verses 18 through 23. Who would like to get that for me, Faith? Okay, so there's a bunch of woe statements there, and we're going to stop. We're going to try to get through the whole chapter today, but we're going to stop right there for now and just take those woe statements in order. So the first one is, woe to an unbelieving people. This is verse 18 and 19. So, and this is a really striking and honestly sort of a difficult mental image. I think it's probably the most difficult bit of poetic imagery in the whole chapter. So he says, woe to those who draw iniquity with cords of falsehood, who draw sin as with cart ropes. So the image here is that there are men harnessed to a cart, pulling behind them a heavy load. And that load is iniquity. And the harness is cords of falsehood. And I think in the translation Faith just read, it said vanity, which I think is probably a better word here, because it's not just falsehood. Falsehood gives the idea that, you know, that there's like some intentional deception going on, and that's not quite it. Vanity is a lie. Vanity is a falsehood, but vanity is specifically a nothingness. It's like an outer shell. It looks good on the outside, but inside it's just empty. That's what vanity means, and so. It's without reality. It is the lie. So by means of vanity, men are dragging iniquity after them. here's what I think Isaiah is trying to say. Some men strain and struggle to accomplish a good thing. One of my favorite historical figures is William Wilberforce, who I wrote my high school senior year term paper about. Wilberforce was a Christian, and of course the thing that we know him for, and of course the thing that he's sort of remembered for. Now, he did a lot of other really important things, and that's actually what my term paper was about. But the thing that we remember him for is for his fight against the slave trade in England, which he did eventually shut down. And then after he shut that down, he continued to fight for complete abolition. So not just we can no longer trade in slaves, but any slaves that are owned, we need to free those people. And he didn't see that in his lifetime, but very shortly after his death, England completely abolished slavery. And so he's somebody who really fought and struggled and strained his entire life, ruined his health in the process, so that he could accomplish something good. Some men strain and struggle to accomplish a good end. The men of Judah, though, are straining and struggling and working as hard as they possibly can to sin, to achieve iniquity. And I have to say, this is sort of taking it to a new level. Most of my sins, most of the sins I struggle with are things that really don't require a lot of effort on my part. Like, that's the whole point. Like, that's the problem. That's the, you know, I have to exert effort to stay away from those things. But the men of Judah have gone so far beyond where they should be. They've gone so far beyond what is good and what is righteous that they are struggling and straining to outdo each other in their iniquity. And their means of doing so is vanity. It is something which looks like something, but it is not. It is a vanity solidly rooted in unbelief. So if it's hard to understand what this vanity is, we get a really good example of it in verse 19. It says, these are people who say, let him, that's the Lord, be quick. Let him speed his work that we may see it. Let the counsel of the Holy One of Israel draw near. Let it come that we may know it. Here's what they're saying. They're saying if there really is a God, let him go. You know, if God is really going to judge the way that you're saying he's going to judge, Isaiah, let's see it. Let's, you know, we'll believe it when we see it. We'll, you know, if God is real and he's really going to judge the way you say that he's going to judge, then why isn't it happening yet? Why isn't he doing it? You know, if there's really something to this, we should be able to see it. And I think we've probably all heard something like this from a lot of people in our culture today, certainly from the less honest sort of atheist. There are sort of two kinds of atheists. The most common kind is the dishonest atheist. The dishonest atheist is someone who is very angry with God, who doesn't believe that God exists and is very angry with God for not existing. And it's, you can't be angry at someone you don't believe in, right? And so I'm sorry, but you know, people who make a big deal about I'm an atheist and you know, these are the Richard Dawkins of the world, and certainly we can all think of maybe somebody that we've met like this. Those are people, they're dishonest atheists. If you're an honest atheist, you wouldn't care what anybody else believed because it doesn't matter anyway, right? Nothing matters anyway. So why do you care? But I'm sure we've all heard something like this from, you know, the Richard Dawkins of the world. But if God really exists, why, you know, strike me dead right now. If God really exists, why doesn't he show himself? If God really exists, why doesn't he cure cancer or end war or all these other things? That's the kind of unbelief. That's the vanity which Isaiah is talking about. It's vanity because it looks like something else. And in fact, in many cases, it looks like it's really intellectual. It looks like it's really educated. But really, it's nothing. Really, it has nothing to offer. It has no hope. It has no substance. You cannot live on nihilism alone. But I think also, this is the sort of thing we're likely to find in the practical atheist. I said a moment ago that there were two kinds of atheists, but I was wrong. There are actually three. There's that honest atheist, which is a very rare thing, and honestly just a pitiable thing. There's that dishonest atheist, that person who's very angry with God. But there's also the what I like to call the practical atheist. And this is the sort of person you are very likely to meet in pretty much any given church in America today. This is somebody who believes that God exists. Like, intellectually, theoretically, they acknowledge God exists. But they don't really look for him to work. They don't really look to see him working in their life. They are more like, and when they see something that might be the work of God or the punishment of God or the hand of God or the blessing of God, they're much more likely to just sort of chalk it up to ordinary natural things or human causes, as though God doesn't work through those things, as though it's got to sort of be like, unless I see the loaves and the fishes multiplying before me, it's not really the hand of God. And they're not looking for God to work. That is a vanity. That is something which looks like something. In this case, it looks like religion, right? But it's nothing. There's no hope. It has no substance to it. It's got no form to it. It's not something which you can really live on. This taunting of the Holy One of Israel, and we can go back to chapter 1, verse 4, where we see this condemned. This taunting of the Holy One of Israel is the very depth of depravity. And you should see by now that we've moved into a very different kind of sin than greed or alcoholism, which are sort of the first two that are mentioned. And we've come into a new kind of sin. This is a sin of the spirit. This is a sin of man's spiritual nature. It's not just about satisfying my fleshly, base, animal urges. This is a very intellectual sin. This is the kind of intellectual sin which a very squeaky, clean person who is faithful to his wife and a good father to his children can be guilty of and which can imperil his soul. Woe to an unbelieving people. And then the next kind of sin, the next woe statement is, woe to a truth-perverting people. Verse 20. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Irreverence and wickedness are close partners. Those who mockingly ask why God isn't carrying out his purposes, and those who are also going to be the people who overthrow and obliterate moral distinctions. This is, something we talk about a lot, especially in the context of witnessing and apologetics, is that once you've rejected God, once you've rejected the idea that there's any kind of an objective moral value to things, that there's a lawgiver, at that point, it becomes very easy for morals to be turned on their head. And so in America today, in the world today, we have a lot of people, very nice, reasonable people, who are calling evil good and good evil. And they're looking at good and saying that's intolerant and that's bigoted and that's medieval and that's ancient and that's wrong. And that's, regressive is the word they use. And then they're looking at things that are evil and they're saying, this is tolerant and this is progressive. Progress used to just mean moving forward in a direction. Well, if you're moving forward in the wrong direction, it may not be a good thing. But it's one of the things that's happened over about the last 100 years is that progress has come to be specifically a good thing. And anything which is regressive, anything which is anything other than progress is automatically considered to be a bad thing. That's one of the biggest paradigm shifts which has happened. It started in about the 1890s, and it's one of the biggest ways in which the way that we think about the world has changed in human history. And I think the cause of a lot of where we are today. So this condemnation applies to a really large segment of the population here. This isn't just the wealthy people. This isn't just the rulers that Isaiah is calling out here. And he does spend a lot of time calling out wealthy people and calling out the rulers because these are people who are in positions, who are in a capacity to really do a lot of harm with their wealth and with their influence. But in this case, this includes people from all walks of life. These are people who have subverted moral distinctions. These are people who are calling evil good, they're calling darkness light, they're calling bitter sweet, and as a result, society is descending into chaos, which is, again, this sounds really familiar. It is one thing for a person to be at a place where they know that they're sinning and they do it anyway. It's another thing entirely for them to call what they are doing good and to look upon good and call it evil. But that's the reversal of norms, which Isaiah sees in his day, and which I believe we are seeing repeated in our day today. Now, it's really easy to be hard on the world, how they call evil good and good evil, but we do this too. We do it so well that we don't know when we're doing it. And I think that's a good reminder, because it's a good reminder that people in the world, they don't always know they're doing it either, right? And that's why they need the truth, and that's why they need that paradigm shift. They need to look at things differently. They need that sort of turn the direction that they're looking at things so that they can understand what it is they've been saying. But we do this all the time, and we'll take and especially in the ways that our pride and our self-righteousness manifests. You know, it's really easy to be very, very proud and very, very concerned about whether or not you're right, and whether or not specifically whether or not you won the argument you just had, right? And that's really just pride. That's really just self-righteousness. But what we can call that is we can say, well, I'm just very zealous for the truth. And we can tell ourselves that. And we can really believe it. But we're not doing it in an attitude which would please the Lord. And then woe to a self-wise people. This is verse 21. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and shrewd in their own sight. So to be perverted in the way that Isaiah has described, the word of God has to have been abandoned as a source of wisdom. And in fact, we see this in verse 24. It says, they've rejected the law of the Lord of hosts and have despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. They've abandoned the word of God as a source of wisdom, and they have exchanged, the people of Judah have fallen into a way of thinking that is right in their own eyes, not one which appeals to any kind of a higher standard. Now, one of my personal crusades, and I have many, and some of them are more trivial than others, but one of my personal crusades, and it started out as sort of a tongue-in-cheek thing, but it's getting increasingly serious, is I would like to do away with the word worldview. I would like to do away with it entirely. The term worldview comes from Cartesian philosophy, the philosophy of René Descartes. And he was a French philosopher, total heathen. He's not wrong about everything. He's wrong about a whole lot of stuff. And the one particular idea, the idea of the worldview, it's essentially this idea that we can pick and choose the way that we look at the world. And so it's the idea. And this has crept into a lot of our teaching in the church, and you know, we do worldview studies classes and things like that. And certainly the idea that is behind that, and like the motive behind that rather, is I think a commendable one. But what it does is it creates this false idea that I can step outside of everything, and I can step outside of myself, and I can step outside of my upbringing, and I can step outside of all these different things, and I can say, here's a whole wall of worldviews, and I think this is the right one. I'm going to pick that one. Now I'm going to put that one on. Like, that's the assumption that goes into that terminology. The term I like better, it's not original with me, but the term I like better is social imaginary. Now, why social imaginary? The term implies two things. I'll start with the second word, imaginary. Because the way that we relate to the world around us is not just in terms of things that we can physically touch. In fact, most of the ideas that we're talking about, most of the ideas that we talk about in this room every single day are things which are not physical realities, and they are rather the things which we have to engage with our imaginations, to engage with God, to engage with the concepts of right and wrong. It doesn't mean these things aren't real. It doesn't mean that they aren't concrete in a metaphysical sense, but they're not things that we can pick up and touch and taste and handle. And All of our metaphors for understanding them involve picking things up and touching them and tasting them and handling them. That's what comprehend means. It means to seize and hold on to something, right? But these are things we have to engage with in our imagination. So that's the imaginary part of social imaginary. And then the social part of social imaginary basically sort of acknowledges that we are products of our upbringing, but we're also products of the people that we put ourselves around. And we're products of the, you know, we're products of the literature that we engage with and the media that we engage with. And we're not a single worldview at a single point in time. We are in a stream of time with a lot of other humans. And we're touching them and engaging with them. And as we do, it's changing the way that we conceive of the world around us. So it seems like a bit of a semantic difference. It is a semantic difference. I think semantics are important. The social imaginary of Judah, and I would say the social imaginary of the United States today, is one which conceives, and you have to understand, this is why you can talk and you can go in giant circles with people for hours and hours about, you know, but don't you see that if you don't believe in a God, then you can't believe in a system of right and wrong. And if you don't believe in a system of right and wrong, then anything goes. And you can look at all the worst atrocities that have happened in human history. And you can look at Genghis Khan and Joseph Stalin and Pol Pot and that Hitler guy. And you can look at all of them and say it's all fine. It all goes. And people will say, no, I'm not saying that. That's okay. I'm not saying that's okay at all. It's because their social imaginary is one in which right and wrong are dictated by society. But it's not just dictated by society. It's dictated by the most recent and the most current society. It's doing what is right in their own eyes. And this is the major shift in thinking which Western culture underwent as a result. It started in the Enlightenment. That's not when the shift really took place, but that's when it started. These are people who have progressed from the mere blindness of access. Remember, we talked about the fixins and how they're really just their blindness to the gifts of God, or their blindness to the fact that God gave these things, right? A porn addict has become blind to the goodness of God in giving love. He's become blind to the hand of the giver. The greedy man has become blind to the goodness of God in giving in giving earthly goods. The drunkard has become blind to the goodness of God in giving wine to gladden the hearts of men. Like that's blindness. But that's a blindness of excess. It's a good love, but it's a love in excess. This, we've now come to the opposite side of the spectrum of sin. We've now come to a place where it's not just a love in excess, it is a total inversion of the natural order. Yes?
When you're dealing with a situation like that, where you're, and it's not even just social sometimes, but even a one-on-one situation with somebody where their view is, you like those circles that you talk about, mm-hmm. where you can never ever look in the same direction. At what point, what do you do in those situations when you're in those conversations with those people? Like,
Well, that's what I want to do. I will tell you, I can give you an example of something which has worked well for me, and I don't know your situation and the people in your life, so I can't say this is going to work in every situation because humans are super different. Got a good friend who, when we really started communicating and conversing, he's a homosexual. When we really started communicating and conversing, he was coming from this completely different place, right? Completely different, shifted, inverted, very nice guy, extremely nice guy, very loving to all of the people in his life, but really saw no place at all for, here's the problem with somebody who's a very loving person. They don't understand, they think they're a loving person, and they're like, so why do I need God? Like, why do I need the Bible? Like, why do I need any of those things? We both have a deep and abiding love of fantasy literature. So using that, and basically I got to a point where I realized, all right, we can't just talk about, it's not enough to be like, I'm going to go presuppositional apologetics on you until you just break. Because it's not going to work with this guy. I mean, first of all, he's a math PhD. He's an incredibly smart dude, wicked smart dude, right? But he's that's just not going to work on me. And so through the use of you know, that we both had this love for fantasy literature, I was able to look at the things that he did love and the things that were common ground between us and say, okay, but you see, there's this conflict here between good and evil. And you accept that. You accept that there has to be good in the world and evil in the world. Like, you accept that, and it's something which you base your, I mean, you base your life around that idea. So why do you base your life around that? You know, let's talk about that. And through those conversations, it's never one conversation, but through many years of conversations, right, we've been able to find that common ground, and really just building off of that, we've been able to come around to a position where it's been a complete turnaround. And he accepts God, and he accepts the Bible, and he accepts that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. And that's a really dramatic turnaround, but it just took a long time. And it's all grace, and it's all the Lord. But to me, I guess what I'm saying is, to me, the yes, Granny.
What do you do with Matthew 7 and 6?
Matthew 7 and 6. Like, which parts of them? Oh, 7 verse 6. Let me look it up. Let me look it up. Do not give to dogs what is holy, and do not throw your pearls before pigs, lest they trample them underfoot and turn to attack you. That's like a whole sermon by itself. Okay, yes.
That's the mocker.
That's the mocker. It is the mocker. It is the mocker.
More difficult to communicate.
Right, so there are people, and that's the other thing. Like I said, people are different. People are different. Like, I can talk with this friend, and we can have these conversations, because he knows I love him, right? But I had to build that. Like, we had to have, like, a relationship and a common ground, but then finding that common ground, we're able to come out and say, like, for me, I'm a storyteller, I love stories, and for me, stories, not arguments, have always been the most powerful ways to reach people. When you have somebody like this, though, when you have somebody like this, and this is in the context of judging others, right? The verses that come before that, judge not that you be not judged, for with the judgment you pronounce, you will be judged, and with the measure you use it, it will be measured to you. Why do you see the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, when there is a log in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. Do not give dogs what is holy, and do not throw your pearls before pigs, lest they trample them underfoot and turn to attack you. So that's the context of that. Judgment, and passing judgment in this case, I think Jesus is talking to people like the scribes and the Pharisees, right? And he's saying, you've got these huge, major problems with the way that you relate to God, but you're going around trying to judge other people and tell them to get themselves right with God. And I think what Jesus is saying is, people like that are the dog. People like that are the pig. People like that, on those people, the good things of God are wasted. No, it's fine. It's fine. That's good. I want you guys to ask questions. I absolutely want you guys to ask questions. So I think it really depends on the person. And this is why Proverbs says two verses in a row, do not answer not a fool according to his folly, right? And then the next verse it says, answer a fool according to his folly. And somebody a long time ago, and I would like to get this person and wring their neck, but somebody a long time ago started a sort of a thing that there are four different Hebrew words for fool, and one of these, there are not four, that's not at all true. Like, no. Like I'm not a Hebrew scholar, and I know this. Like, you can very easily, like, if you've got one of these keywords studied about, there are not four Hebrew words for fool. Don't know where that came from. Same word. Two verses in a row. Don't answer a fool according to his folly. Answer a fool according to his folly. Why? Because there are some fools that if you answer them according to their folly, they will see, oh yeah, when somebody says it back at me, my folly really sounds pretty stupid. And then there are fools, upon whom it is wasted, like, because they don't get it. Like, they're not perceptive enough, and they don't get it. And so I think there are people, and specifically in the context of Matthew chapter 7, I think these are people who are very religious people, and who are very, and the kind of people who are always looking to point out flaws in others, upon whom the word of God is just going to be like pearls before a swine. Like, they have no way of comprehending what this is or why it's beautiful or why it's good for them. Because what they're really concerned about is the speck in somebody else's eye. So there are those people. I want to give you like a really clever answer here, but I don't have the wisdom to know which people are which people all the time. Now, through experience and through hard knocks, I have figured it out with some people and just realized that this is not going anywhere with some people. God may still have work to do with you, but it's not going to be through me. And that's a really, really hard thing to, it's just a really hard thing. And where you hit that line for you, I think you've got to be praying over these things. You've got to really seek the Lord. So I don't know how it's going to be in each individual situation. Yes, Natalie.
I just wanted to point out with your friend that you kind of have been changing the social imaginary.
Right.
Because he was willing to go with you.
Right.
But at any point there, if
he
hadn't been willing to go with you, he would have been passing the problem.
Right.
Believe in
pearls. Exactly. So that's a great question. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to stop right there. We're going to stop right there because I'm only two pages through my notes. And those are really good questions. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And thank you. Please ask. No, really. Honestly, I don't want this to be a one-way conversation. I want you guys to ask the questions because those are good questions. And that's a hard question. And it really frustrates me that I don't have something like clever to answer you, but
well, there is no pet answer because the Bible
of course
is
not.
Big.
No. Yes.
You just got to layer upon layer.
Yeah.
We need repetition.
Exactly.
Repetition.
Exactly.
There are layers of sin that need to be peeled away.
And you know, there are people who, when I try to minister to these people, here's what I'll say in closing: there are people who, when I try to minister to those people, are going to be, I'm the wrong person to do it. Like, I don't have the credibility. I don't have the relationship with them, or I just don't have, like, whatever, you know. There's some people who really want to listen, and if a paleontologist comes along and tells them, well, here's how the fossil record actually supports the Genesis account, boom, that's what they needed. Most people, I think, are not like that. That's not really what they need. But there are people who are like that, and for those people, I'm not the guy. Like, I can repeat other arguments that people have told me and other things that I've heard, but I'm not a paleontologist, and even if I'm right, they're not going to. Why would they listen to me, right? But there are some people to whom Beowulf may be the door to the kingdom of heaven, and for those people, I am here.
No.
You laugh.
No.
You laugh, but it's, I'm deadly serious about it. So
there's
it's
a relationship.
Right,
there.
Right.
So
it's. Right. 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 So it's build the relationships with people and we see, I think in Isaiah what we're seeing is that's the heart of God is his relationship with the people of Judah. So all right, so we're going to close right there on woe to a self-wise people. Next week we're going to do the justice perverting people. And then we're going to look at the judgment and then some application, although I think we've already gotten some really good application in the last 2 weeks. My hope was really next week to be able to get onto Isaiah's vision of a holy God in chapter 6. And maybe we still will, but I kind of think not. So, all right, let's pray. Dear Lord, thank you so much for this good time of fellowship and this good time of teaching, and for these hard questions that people are asking. Lord, there are no easy answers for how to deal with people when they've rejected your word. Lord, we know that your judgment is certain and sure, but that your mercy is freely and widely offered, and that those two things are universal, but that in the ways that you show your mercy, in the ways that you manifest your love to each of us that you do it in a time which is good for us and in a way which is what our souls need. And Lord, my prayer for everyone here is that you would just make us the vessels to other people of your love and of your grace. Thank you so much for the people that you use to extend that love to each of us, and for all the people, and for your Son, who have not given up on us when we were in sin, and when we were lost. Pray these things in Jesus' name.